W from Los Angeles.
Hey, where's everybody going? What? Good evening. My name's Ronald White, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to start off by thanking the Atlanta Roundup Committee for having the audacity to ask me to come and share. It's always an honor and a privilege to be able to come speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have some very dear friends in the crowd, some people that I grew up with in sobriety in Los Angeles who relocated to Atlanta. I've got a sponsee that flew out to be with me from Vermont. Got some people who live out here in Atlanta who I've met on other conventions that I've really gotten to know, and this is a special occasion for me. I need to get something out of the way because I be tripping sometimes when I share. I was looking at the screen over here, and I was thinking to myself, the contrast is much too dark. They won't be able to see my face. I'm sorry. Is that vanity or what? It's like, I'm sorry. I had to get it out, y'all, you know, because I'm... Anyway, that being said... In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a chapter, chapter 7. It's a chapter called Working with Others. And in that chapter, it talks about our 12th step of recovery. The step that says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And it outlines in great detail in that chapter how I'm supposed to share with the new man or woman in a general way, what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. It's quite fashionable to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous nowadays and hear people share, I'm not going to stay in no drunkalog. We all know how to drink. I want to talk about recovery, about the steps, about the process, about the work. And I think it's important, it's vital, that I talk about our plan, program of action, our 12 steps of recovery. But you know something? I think it's probably even more important that I share with you what I used to be like. Because there's somebody sitting in this room tonight looking at Ronald White, and I think I look kind of nice, right? Rather dapper, right? You know, I'll describe it for the people on the tape. I have... A bit of an Oxford look, you know, with my suit, and I've got this nice polka dot tie and a matching hanky. And my shoes are matching one another. And there's no tape on my glasses. I stand about 6 feet four with long, flowing blonde hair, and I took it a little far, right? Because I'm an alcoholic, right? I am excessive. And all kidding aside, somebody's looking at me tonight, and they're thinking, he doesn't look like me. He doesn't look like no drunk. Look at him. He looked like a preacher or a teacher or somebody they invited from the Screen Actors Guild to come out here and read a script about, you know, the triggers. Somebody might be fooled by this exterior. You know, and they might think that somehow I might be special. They asked me to share at the convention. You know, he's name dropping. You know, he's got all these friends. He's got look at my ass. I'm lost, and I'm alone. I'm fresh out of a recovery home, or maybe in a recovery home, or in an abandoned apartment. I have no friends. I've burned every bridge. I have nobody that was glad to see me coming. I've I feel alone in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've tried to get this thing, and I've slipped and I've relapsed over and over, man. I don't have what it takes. He's not like me. What can this lame share with me that I can identify with? And I like to share my first day of recovery. July the 14th of 1986. That's right, I just celebrated 30 years. I had to drop that in there, right? I know, it's just unbelievable. How could he be 30 years sober? He looks like he's 30, right? You know? July the 14th of 1986, I found myself standing in the lobby of a joint called the Harbor Light Center. It's a place run by the Salvation Army. It was located on the Nickel in downtown Los Angeles. The Nickel is 5th Street, Skid Row, in the middle of downtown Los Angeles. The Salvation Army Harbor Light Center was an all-men's alcoholic recovery facility that housed 150 beds for alcoholic men. I'm standing in the lobby being interviewed by an old black guy named George. George had a rumpled brown suit on with a brown fedora kind of like tilted rakishly on his head, right? Thought he looked cool, right? I thought he would look square, but, you know, who was I to judge? And he was standing there with a folder just like this with a list of questions. You know those questions they ask you to see if you qualify for one of those beds in that recovery home. George asked me, you know, complex questions. George asked me, "Mr. White, how much do you drink?" You know, tough stuff, right? You know, and I remember I mumbled my answer. And George asked me another question, and I mumbled my answer. And as George is asking me the questions, and I'm mumbling my answers, I'm looking down at these dirty, beat-up tennis shoes that I'm wearing. I'm looking down at the shoes because it felt like my chin was stapled to my chest because I was so ashamed of being there. And George is asking me the questions, and I'm mumbling my answers. And my eyes traveled up from those beat-up tennis shoes that I'm wearing, and they rested upon these gray corduroy pants that I'm wearing. And the pants are real dusty and dirty because I've been wearing them 5 weeks on a run, and I had not bothered to change. And if I had hit the pants too hard, a cloud of smoke would have filled the lobby. That's how filthy they were. And the pants weren't fitting me nicely like this suit is this evening. The pants were kind of like hanging off of me. I don't know if you guys in Atlanta have that style of dress the youngsters have, right? Where the pants are down, you know, around their ankles damn near. Or, what do they call it? Like, sagging, right? Well, that wasn't the style back in 86. And I was not a youngster. I was 31 years old. But I'm an alcoholic. When I drink, I don't stop to or bother to eat. So imagine me about 40 or 50 pounds lighter than I am this evening. That's right, I'm a small guy anyway. Drop 40 off me, I look like a skeleton. Cheeks sunk in, eyes popping out my head. I look like one of those kids on those commercials for famine in Africa. I'm wearing an overcoat because I don't want you to see how malnourished I've become. I told you it was July in L.A. in the middle of a heat wave, and I've got this big-ass coat on that I wear everywhere that I go. And I'm not talking about no nice, you know, fashionable London fog or no cashmere, nothing like that. I'm talking about one of those black, seedy, Chester the Molester-looking coats, right? Right. Ah! Right? And you did not want me to do that, right? You know. I have a baseball cap pulled tightly over my head because by now I have no personal hygiene. I've stopped bathing. I've stopped combing my hair. My hair is all matted. You know, if you have the opportunity to come up here at the end of the meeting and take a look at these, you know, little curls that I have. They call them twists, right? Yeah, my hair was twisted back then, right? You know, matted. And if you had smelled me that morning, you know the stench that an alcoholic has on them when they've been drinking for years and it's coming out your pores and you haven't bathed and you're wearing the same underwear, the same drawers you've been wearing for weeks. And when you try to change, you almost have to like peel it off of you because it's gotten so black and caked. Don't judge me. Wait a minute. I see some of y'all in here like, ugh. Like, I know what room I'm in, right? You know, some of you guys in here know what I'm talking. No, wait, don't let me discriminate. Some of you women in here know what I'm talking about. I sometimes add, if you were wearing underwear. But, you know, that's another story. Because, you see, I'm an alcoholic. When I drink, I become an animal. Under the lash of alcohol, you cannot even recognize me. And I'm standing in that lobby and I'm answering those questions, hoping desperately that they would give me a bed. Because, you see, it wasn't, I never had a thought that I would ever arrive at that point. It wasn't one of the top 10 goals of my life to grow up to become a drunk. I had never had any aspirations about growing up to be standing in the Harbor Light Center at age 31 begging them for a bed. In fact, quite the opposite. I thought I could never become an alcoholic because, you see, the first resentment I had in my life was against my father. Because my father was a drunk. My father was a wino. And I swore I would never grow up to be like him. And because of that resentment, because of that vow, for the first 18 years of my life, I drank nothing. Didn't even think about using anything else. But you know something? Even while growing up, not drinking, I still had what I've come to know as the ism of alcoholism. If you ever have the opportunity to read our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the front of our book they have something called the doctor's opinion, where the doctor that worked with the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. William Silkworth, I was reading this beautiful chronology that we have over here. If you have an opportunity, please look at that, because there is a chronology, and I see Dr. William Silkworth in that chronology. And Dr. Silkworth, who ran Towns Hospital, that worked with one of the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, he said that he had studied thousands of alcoholics, and he noticed they had certain things in common. One of the things he said they had in common is they seemed to have what he called an allergic reaction to alcohol, that when they drank, they craved more. But that didn't really interest me when I first read the doctor's opinion, because I told y'all I didn't drink anything for the first 18 years of my life. But Dr. Silkworth wrote something else. He said these alcoholic men and women, when not drinking, seem to suffer from feelings of being irritable, restless, discontented, kind of not at ease with themselves, diseased. And I identify with that. Because, you see, even before I started drinking, I've always felt dis-ease. I know it's hard to fathom, but I've always felt like I was ugly. Isn't that amazing, right? How could this handsome... Well, anyway, I've always felt that I was too short. Somebody in the room is one of, we got some little guys in this room that have suffered from little man's complex, right? You know, all my life, while growing up, I have five brothers. There's six boys in my family. And I've always felt out of all six of us, I'm in the middle. I'm the number three son. And I've always, out of all six of us, I've always been the shortest. And I've always suffered from those feelings that there's something wrong with me. I mean, I know I've hit the growth spurt. What you see is what you get. I'm not going, you know, I'm 5'4" and a half. That's right, a half. That's right, give me all mine, right, you know. And I've always had this thing about my height. But not only was I short, I was always small. I was thin, I was skinny. And in my neighborhood, all the boys judged each other's self-worth by how well we played sports. And I wasn't good at sports. I was weak. I couldn't hit a baseball real far. I couldn't throw a football or shoot hoops. We would have pickup games in the alley behind our little apartment. The best two athletes would be on opposite teams. All the other boys would be in a circle waiting to be chosen. We'd be waving our hands, pick me, pick me. And they say, I'll take Jimmy, I'll take Ralph, I'll take Teddy, I'll take Bobby. And they always got to the end, and it was always me and some fat guy. And somebody would say, all right, I'll take Ronnie. And they don't know how that made me feel inside. Like I was less than, like I was a burden. I've always hated being so black. And I don't mean being black, but damn it, so black. Even black people discriminated against me, right? You know, it's just like darky, skillet, you know, just, you know, I grew up in the 50s and in the 60s before James Brown came out with I'm Black and I'm Proud, right? You know, and I know this is my perception. I always believed that the members of my race thought that the lighter your skin was, the handsomer you were or the prettier you were. And I never wanted to be white. I just wanted to be high yellow, you know, with good hair, right? You know, just, I could go on and on reciting a litany of the things that I hated about myself, the things that made me a prisoner of my thinking. Wearing these damn glasses since the second grade, always being called Poindexter, Mr. Peabody, Four Eyes. You know, all of those things, man, shoot, I needed a drink. As I grew up, man, because I needed escape. I needed release. But I could not escape because I did not want to become my father. And I had to find something to help me escape. I need to let you know, the place that I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, in Watts, with my mother and father. And my mother and father raised six boys. And they, you know, I told you I'm the third of the six. There's Willie, there's Ralph, Ronald, Reggie, Ricky, and Rod. Some of you guys have had the pleasure of hearing my brother Ralph before. So you might hear some of the same stuff. He stole it from me. I've been sober 8 months longer than him, right? Not really, only 88 days, but who's counting? And as we grew up in that household with that father who would get paid on Friday and not make it home until Sunday because he loved Ripple, a cheap wine that they made in the 50s and in the 60s. And when he would make it home, he was broke. And when he made it home, he made my mother cry because he didn't have enough money. And I wondered what was wrong with him. Why didn't he love us enough to bring home the money? What was wrong with us? What was wrong with me? And I needed escape from that. The thing that I found that helped me escape from the prison of my thinking as I grew up were books. I became addicted to reading. Libraries became my sanctuary because, you see, when I read, I escaped. And I was no longer on 108th and Central in the middle of Watts. I was somewhere, and I was transported to distant lands. I was somewhere in Europe or in Paris. I love spy novels. I love espionage because I love the heroes as they were depicted in those books. They were guys who were, you know, tall, dark, and handsome. I had one of those. I'll let you guess which one, right? They were guys who were exciting. They were saving the world or getting the girl at the end of the story, right? They were guys who knew karate, and they were like, hi! See, how can you describe it for people on the tape? That they just miss that, right? Just no lessons either. Just and these books freed me. I would be transformed into these characters in these books, man, and they helped me survive. But I need to let you know that I understand looking back on my life, because that's the way you understand it, looking back. Everything I've ever latched onto that's helped me escape from who and where and what I was, after a while, it didn't seem to have the same effect it did in the beginning. And I require more. My disease, which centers in my thinking, is progressive in nature. And after a while, reading those novels didn't have the same effect they did in the beginning. And I required something bigger, something faster, something stronger. And I discovered comic books. Because the stories were shorter and quicker, and the heroes were bigger and stronger. And I latched on to a line of comics made by a company called DC. DC Comics made Superman, Batman, The Flash, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Atom, Hawkman, the Legion of Superheroes, the Justice League of America. And Ronald became a superhero named Mon-El, right? You know. I would go in my mother's closet and I grab one of her towels, and that towel became a cape. And I would tie it around my neck, and I would go out on 108th Street, and I would just get this running start, and I would jump and I would fly down the Central Avenue. Now, I don't know if you guys know anything about Watts in the 60s. Probably one of the most dangerous cities in the nation, in the world. And you would have thought that I would have felt embarrassed, ashamed, frightened of running down the street with a towel on my neck. But you know something? When I put on that towel, when I put on that cape, I felt no fear. Because you see, it made me feel strong. It made me feel heroic. It made me feel powerful. And even back then, lack of power was my dilemma. And I was willing to go to any length to feel the sense of power. However, I suffer from a disease that is progressive in nature. I told y'all, after a while, a few years of running down the street with that towel, I did start feeling a little foolish. And I needed something else. And my family purchased, this is the early 60s now, my family purchased a small black and white television. And I fell in love with TV. I was glued to the TV every day. They used to call me the human TV guide. As I'm glued to the television, neighbors would come by and my brothers would play a game. I would hear the door open and Ralph would say, "Hey man, watch this. Ronnie, Wednesday, 8 o'clock. I say, 8 o'clock? Channel 2 is Gunsmoke. Channel 4 is Mannix. Channel 5 is Donna Reed. Channel 7 is Petticoat Junctions." Now, some of our younger members look puzzled when I say the names of those shows. But some of you who are my contemporaries know those were the shows that I was raised on, that were on TV back in the early 60s, right? I knew whatever was on any channel, any time of the day, any day of the week. Thank God they didn't have cable. Woo. There was a TV show that I gravitated to that later became one of the guiding forces in my life. Some of you guys may remember this TV show. It was a show called Perry Mason. Right? Perry Mason was a criminal defense attorney played by an actor named Raymond Burr. Raymond Burr was one of the handsomest white boys I had ever seen on television. Tall, broad shoulder, jet black hair, slick back. I'm talking about the black and white series, right, before it became Ironside. You know, back Raymond Burr was, man, he was felt. He had these beautiful black suits that, I think they were black. It was black and white television, so it was dark suits he had on. And he would walk around the courtroom with the command and the presence. Now, Perry always had a client on trial for murder or something, right? And his client was in trouble, and it was the end of the episode every week. And he would have this last witness on the witness stand, and he wasn't getting nowhere with him. And his private eye, Paul Drake, would come in the back door, right, with a little note. And he'd give it to Perry. Perry would read that note, man, and he would look at that witness, and the witness would get nervous.
start to fidget around on the witness stand, right? And get to, and Perry wasn't having it. He would just close in, and Perry would say, "Isn't it true?" And they, "Yes, yes." Or somebody in the back of the courtroom would jump up, "I did it." Now, I know we have a few members in here who've been in court before. I suspect that. And you know it don't go down like that, right? But that's the way that I envisioned it happening. And man, I loved it. Because Perry seemed like he was more than just a lawyer. He was a detective and a forensic scientist. And I think he was a lover. I think him and Della, you know. But that's who I wanted to be. I wanted somebody to look at me like Perry's client looked at him at the end of the episode with that, "You're my hero." I wanted somebody to look at me like that. And I thought, maybe I could do that. See, Perry wasn't somebody in a novel or in a comic book. He was a real person. I could see him on the television. And I thought, maybe I could do that. Because Perry had power. He had power to bend people's will to his simply by the force of his presence and his words. And I thought I could do that. So I grew up wanting to be Perry Mason. I wanted to be a lawyer. As I came through school, I was a straight A student on the honor roll at every school that I went to because my addiction to reading made me ready-made for school. I was the most articulate kid in every class that I had. I was well-read. The teacher always called on me to read the lessons. I had a vivid imagination from all that television and movies and books, so I was great at writing essays. I was a chameleon. I would know how to be this actor that the teacher would want me to be. So, man, I excelled in class. And so I get to this high school in South Central Los Angeles called Locke High School. When I go to Locke, I joined this marching band that was famous at the time. We were called the Locke High Marching Saints. They used to call us Little Grambling at the time because we would march this fast cadence. And I played trombone in the band and marched in what we called the front rank. We marched in the Rose Parade in Pasadena on New Year's. And we went to Hawaii for the Aloha Parade. And a few of us in that band formed a jazz group that went to the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles and competed in the Battle of the Bands, and we won sweepstakes as the top jazz band in the nation. I was elected my senior class president when I got to the 12th grade. I got accepted to go to college on a full academic scholarship at a school called Loyola University. It's now called Loyola Marymount University, a private Jesuit school in Westchester, in a suburb of Los Angeles. And here I'm a Baptist kid, raised in the Baptist church by my mama, and this is a Catholic school. I don't know nothing about Catholics, right? You know, but they've accepted me to go to their school free. They're paying for everything because of my grades. Now, you know from my sharing, you would think that I had some things that I had done that I could be proud of. I had some accomplishments. I had some blessings that I had been given, right? But guess what? I'm an alcoholic in waiting. I haven't even taken a drink yet, but I still have the ism. Because anything you give me, after a while, it's not good enough. Because I always require more. And my blessings never seem to be as good as your blessings. I don't want to be a straight-A student. Because I want to be like those kids that are hanging out by the hash lines where you get your rolls and your stuff that are, you know, two or three of them hanging together, never going to class, jiggling their change in their pockets and stuff. Girls walking by and they say, "Hey, baby, and the girls would go, and I say, "What did they say?" Right? You know, I never knew what to say to make a girl laugh like that, right? And while I would be looking down at these guys, I always envied them because I wanted what they had. Because in and of myself, I'm a scared little kid. I won't even try to talk to a girl because I fear rejection so much. I never want to be a scholar. I want to be an athlete. I want to be one of those kids scoring touchdowns, a quarterback, somebody they're writing about in the L.A. Times, somebody that's got cheerleaders cheering for them on the sideline. Nobody ever came in science class, "Yes, Ronald, that's the right answer." Right? my ego was not fed enough. See, I didn't even see this back then, that that's what it was, because I craved, even while I wanted to be kind of non, I wanted to be in the spotlight, right? And so I have this duality that has always been in my life where I've always acted better than, but I've always felt less than. Grow up like that. A few of you guys in this room know what I'm talking about. Grow up like that, feeling like a fake and a phony and a fraud, that somebody's going to discover that I'm not as smart as I portray myself to be, and that I will be this imposter or be found out and be ridiculed and laughed. I need to let you know, man, by the time I get to the 12th grade and we graduate and I go to this beach party my 12th grade class was giving for our graduation, right? And it's a night beach party, and I'm walking along the beach with a can of soda, the professor. I did look that bad, too. And I see a guy and a girl, and they're underneath a blanket. And I looked, and the blanket was moving. And I listened. And I heard the girl say, "Ooh." Oh, I'm sorry. It was a little embarrassing. I kind of got lost there. I wanted to get underneath a blanket. But everybody knows I'm the professor. The professor doesn't get underneath blankets, right? And somebody was passing around something, because I wish I remember what it was, because it became my first drink. It was either some Tyrolia or some Spignata, right? High class, right? Cheap wine. Because you see, by now, my thinking told me I could take a drink and I would never become my father. My daddy was a high school dropout. I'm going to college on a scholarship. I am obviously smarter than him. My daddy was a custodian, a janitor. I'm going to be the next Perry Mason. I'm obviously better than him. My ego told me that I could drink and I could never become him. And so I drank. Probably only another alcoholic can truly understand the effect produced in me by alcohol in the beginning, when it was working. Alcohol made me feel taller. Alcohol made me feel bigger. Alcohol made my skin feel lighter. Alcohol made me put my hand in my pocket. And I kind of got this lean, like those guys back at the hash lines. And I just got cool, where I felt like I could breathe. I sometimes wish I was a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I heard a lady share how alcohol made her feel, and it fit the way that I felt. She said, "It made me feel wittier, prettier, and tittier." I sometimes like to see the way the sign interpreters do that. Wittier, prettier, and tittier. You notice I waited for the female signer to be up there before I shared that. Yes. It freed me. Alcohol freed me from every fear and inhibition that I had ever grown up with, and it worked. I used to go to dances when I was in high school,
And they would put these red lights on and stuff to dim it, to make it look romantic and stuff. And this was back in the 70s, right? And they would always, at near the end of the dance, they would put on these slow records, right? So guys and girls could get together and get romantic and stuff and be slow dancing and what have you. And man, they had an old R&B group called the Dells out. And the Dells had a record out at the time called Stay in My Corner. And Stay in My Corner was long and it was slow. And they loved when that record got on, because when they would put on Stay in My Corner, the guys would rush across the floor to get a girl. And man, they put on Stay in My Corner and I'd be staying in my corner. Because I fear rejection so much. I told you that I won't even ask the question, because I know it's going to be no. I know it's going to be a rejection. And man, I'm so full of myself that I know when I hold my hand out to her and she says no, and I have to take that walk of shame back across the dance floor, and they've got that spotlight on me and everybody's laughing and pointing. Ain't nobody thinking about me. But in my head they are, because I am selfish and self-centered to the nth degree. Didn't know it at the time. Didn't know that that's what it was. But looking back, I understand now. I have the ism, right? Still haven't taken a drink yet, right? But man, once I took a drink, I would go to the dances, man, and I had this. Shoot, I was in college, man, and they had a group called Parliament, and Parliament had a record out called Flashlight, and man, and I would get out on the dance floor, and they had a dance called The Bump, and I was. Right? Again, they're missing it on the tape. But I need to let you know, alcohol gave me everything that I needed. Alcohol wasn't the problem, man. Alcohol was the solution. Alcohol was the solution to my thinking problem. It freed me. But unfortunately, like Bill Wilson describes in Bill's story, the thing that I forged is this weapon of thinking and drinking, speculation and drink. Thinking and drinking that helped me get over when I was in college. It saved me in those first years in college, because now I'm no longer this smart fish in this little pond. Now I'm in this big pond of a bunch of smart people, and I need to be able to survive and stuff. And man, alcohol helped me fit in. It helped me believe that I could do it. It gave me the things that I needed to survive. It was the solution. But I need to let you know that after a while, just like everything else I've ever used to escape, it wasn't enough the way it was in the beginning. And I no longer wanted to just feel good at the parties on the weekend. I wanted to feel good on Monday, too. And I wanted to feel that way on Wednesday. And so now I'm drinking every day. It's around my sophomore year of college. It's respecting the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't go into detail with all the other things that I use in addition to my alcoholism, but you need to know that I'm a garbage can. That my drinking opened the door to all kinds of things in my life. And this is the 70s too? You can imagine, man. I was doing everything. Around my third year, alcohol started doing some things to me. Daily drinking takes a toll on being able to go to class. So now I'm missing class. Now I can't keep up, so I have to start cheating on my exams. I'm not in class, so I don't know all the material, so now I start plagiarizing my term papers. Hell, I start buying my term papers from services that used to sell them, ready-made. My spirit started getting real sick. This guy who was the professor, who was the straight-A student, who was the straight arrow, all of a sudden, because alcohol had assumed a much more important place in my life, because remember, it was the solution, now everything else has to take a back seat to that. And so now my values and my morals start to slip. Everything that I used to think that I would not do, now all of a sudden, I used to say stuff like, well, nobody want to be just a bookworm anyway. I want to be a student of life. Right? Somebody in there, right? Because I have to justify my drinking, and I tell myself these lies, and I believe it. Forget telling you the lie, I tell me the lie. And I was believing it, I was accepting it, because alcohol was my savior. That wasn't the problem. You're the problem. Book all these
these rules and regulations are the problem. And so I go through my life now starting to compromise my values because I need to drink, because that saved me. And I graduate from college on time in 4 years, somehow by the grace of God, and I get accepted to go to law school, pursuing Perry Mason. I go to law school in San Francisco at a school called Hastings College of the Law. I didn't realize it was one of the most prestigious law schools in the nation at the time. And the only reason I went there is because I got accepted to go to Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, but I had started to suspect, you know how you start to suspect that, you know, this is kind of a problem, this, you know, this partying. I never really just said to drink. I said this partying is a problem, right? And my brothers, they like to party too much because we all hung out together. I told you, six of us, and we drank together. And I said, if I stay in Los Angeles, they probably going to make me fail law school. And so I did what I now know was a geographic, right? That's what we call it, a geographic. I ran away to San Francisco to go to law school, pursuing Perry Mason. Unfortunately, I took the wrong brother to law school with me, me. And my disease accelerated. I went to summer school after my first year and second year of law school. And I somehow graduate from law school early. I'm law clerking for a guy who was an alcoholic just like me. And I looked at him as my model because he would work hard all day and we would drink hard all night. And I thought that's the way that you do it. And I learned how to take exams and stuff. I didn't go to class at law school, but I learned how to take tests. And I was real good at doing that. I was good at taking in material under pressure. And I would take the test and I would pass, man. And in 1978, December of 1978, just before my 24th birthday, I graduated from law school early, in 2.5 years. All my other classmates were finishing out that last semester to graduate, and I'm sitting around waiting, and they have a test you got to take to be a lawyer called the bar exam. And they're giving one in February, and my graduation isn't until May. And I said, well, nobody passes the bar the first time. Let me just take it as a practice one, right? And so I take the bar exam, and the results happen to come out on the day of my graduation, the last Saturday in May 1979. My family's flown up from Los Angeles. My mom and my brothers are in this little box of an apartment I have, and there's a pounding on the door as we're getting dressed to go to the graduation. I'm putting my gown on and stuff, and my best friend that worked in the law firm burst in the house, and he says, Ronald, they just posted the bar results, and guess what? You passed. And at age 24, I become one of the youngest black attorneys ever licensed to practice law in the state of California. And it always amuses me when they clap during that portion of my pitch because y'all won't be clapping for a while now. Because I'm an alcoholic, right? You know, probably the most dangerous thing you could do to a drunk is give him something, right? Give me some achievements. Give me something to feed my ego. Give me something to think that I'm okay. Because wasn't this an affirmation that everything I've been doing up to this point was the way you're supposed to be living, right? This is the way that you do to be successful. And man, I know that I'm going to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. By the time I was 30, I did not even have a bank account. By the time I was 30, I didn't have a condominium or mansion or a house on the hill. I was living back at home with my mother, sleeping on her floor. By the time I was 30, I didn't have a nice job for a law firm on Wilshire and Westwood in Los Angeles. The only job I had was carrying out the trash and watering the lawn for this dope dealer who lived right across the street from my mother's house. I cannot even imagine the shame and degradation my mother felt looking at this son she had just been so proud of just 5 years before, virtually prostituting himself to this youngster right across the street from her house in her neighborhood in front of her neighbors and friends. You see, alcohol is no respecter of intellect. Alcohol doesn't care if you graduated from law school or if you dropped out from high school. Alcohol does not care if you grew up in Westwood or in Watts. Alcohol does not care if you're black or if you're white. Alcohol doesn't care if you're a man or if you're a woman. Alcohol don't care if you're short or if you're tall. Alcohol is an equal opportunity ass kicker. If you first of all suffer from what I now know, because this becomes real for me, what the doctor wrote about in the doctor's opinion, this physical allergy, this thing that exists in me, this abnormality that when I have a drink, it doesn't quench my thirst, it makes me thirstier. And in fact, it makes me so thirsty that I will do whatever it takes to get another one. I don't think you heard me. I will do whatever it takes to get another one. I was stealing the shoes out of my mother's closet because she wore the same size as the girl around the corner. I stole the food out of my mother's refrigerator to cook plates for people around the neighborhood so that I could get one. I stole a gold watch that my mother had because she... Let me back up a little bit, because if there are new people in the room, you really might be puzzled about this power that this craving might have. And you might not know just how powerful it is if you don't understand the relationship I have with my mother. My mother raised me and my five brothers by herself after putting that drunk of a father out when I was 9 years old. This is a woman who made sure that every Sunday we were in church. We never had a family car, yet she put us all, dressed us all, and put us on a bus to go to church so that we would be spiritually fed. This was a woman who had no high school education, no high school diploma, and she was on welfare when she put him out, but she wanted more for herself and her boys, so this woman put herself into service, cooking and cleaning for other people's families so she could feed and clothe us. We never went hungry. This is a woman who, while doing this, working for other people's families, was active in the PTA, making sure that we were well-fed in school. This is a woman who worked at night. No, she went to school at night to get that high school diploma that she didn't have because she wanted more for her sons. She got that diploma, and she didn't just stop there because she knew that wasn't enough. So what she now starts to do is she's working two jobs. She's going to night school to get a college degree. She's now president of the PTA. She's making sure we're not in church just on Sunday. We go two other times during the course of the week because this is a woman who is, she knows about the power, right? She's not alcoholic. She doesn't even drink. This woman gets a college degree, puts three sons into college, gets a job for Prudential Insurance Company. They give her a gold watch even before she retires because everybody loves my mother so much because of the person she is. I steal that watch. I love my mother more than life. I used to say I would kill anybody that did anything to my mother, and now I'm the one. I'm the wolf in the house. And I've become my father. See, the craving isn't a problem if I don't take the first one. So the solution is simple, right? Just don't take the first one. But there is something different about my thinking that is indescribable to anyone who's never felt this. In the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the chapter called More About Alcoholism, chapter 3, they should call it More About Relapse, because it describes the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. What is it that goes through the mind of the alcoholic when he said he's never going to do it again, and yet he does it anyway? A guy whooped me so bad one time, and I dragged my butt home, and I remember my mother bathed me, nursed me back to health, fed me, and I remember, man, we're sitting there, we prayed. You know that sincere prayer that you do with your mother, man, and we're crying, and I'm crying, and mama's crying, and we pray, and I said, Mama, I'm never gonna do that again, and I mean it. I mean it with all my fiber, and I don't drink on Monday, and I don't drink on Tuesday, and I don't drink on Wednesday, and somewhere around Thursday, my head said, that ass whooping wasn't that bad. Right? Scars healing. but I don't drink.
Friday comes and I get paid and I don't even think about what happened on Sunday. And I am unable to recall with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even days ago, and I'm drunk. There's something, that's the riddle of my illness, that we don't know what it is that goes through the mind of the alcoholic that causes him to be unable to stop himself from having that thought which says, this time it'll be different. Don't always say it like that. Sometimes it just says, if you just change who you drink with, if you just change what you drink, if you just change where you drink, if you just put your money in money orders and mail it back to yourself, if you just give your money to your mama to hold it, if you just put it in the magic vault, the back pocket, if you just... Right? My head tells me a lie, and I am unable to tell the true from the false. I have this inability, right? And until I could address the third part of my illness, that dis-ease of my spirit, because if I feel dis-ease long enough, I will seek ease and comfort. And my head tells me alcohol will do it again like it did in the beginning, and it won't have the consequences that it did last week or yesterday or what have you. And that's the piece. I need some power. On July the 13th of 1986, I stole some money from a guy who gave me some bags of weed to sell for him. And he was a dangerous guy, and it was a Sunday, and I didn't have his money, and I was worried about what would he do to me. And these sisters that were taking care of my mother dropped my mother off from church. And my mother had this beautiful church clothes on, right? And I'm thinking to myself, I have a bright idea. I said, if I take this guy, his name was Kenny. I said, if I take Kenny in my mother's house to explain to him I don't have the money, he won't do anything to me because he respects my mother, right? So unmindful of her welfare, I take this wolf in my mother's house. And my mother's cooking Sunday dinner. And I'm telling Kenny, we're in the living room, and I'm saying, Kenny, I'm sorry, man, I don't have your money, man, but I'll get it back to you. I'm coming with that story, right? And Kenny says, Ronnie, just stop, man. It's fine. It's cool. We can make credit arrangements for you to get the money back, right? Why don't we just step out on the porch and talk about it? I was so happy I didn't catch the sign, right? And so Kenny steps out on the porch, and I start to step out after him, looking back, making sure I could see my mother because she made me feel safe. She couldn't hear what we were talking about, but I knew because she was there, nothing would happen. Well, I stepped out on the porch after Kenny, and Kenny must have been waiting on me. Because, man, when I stepped outside, Kenny must have hit me as hard as he possibly could. And I found myself flying through the air like a superhero without a cape. And I land on my mother's front yard, and I roll over, and Kenny proceeds to run over. And he starts to kick me in the head and stomp me, trying to kill me. And as Kenny is kicking me and stomping me, I felt as if I were removed from my body watching this happen. And I'm looking at Kenny, and he's kicking me and stomping me. And I look over, and I see my mother walk out on the porch. And I expect her to say, stop, stop, that's my baby. But Mama says nothing. And I look back over at Kenny, and he's still kicking me and stomping me. And I look back at Mama, and she turns around and walks back in the house and closes the door. And it was at that moment that I experienced step one. Bill says that quicksand stretched all around me, that nobody could tell me about the bitter morass of loneliness and self-pity that I felt, that alcohol was my master. The next day is when I checked into the Harbor Light. See, I'm a real alcoholic. I like to try to make it sound fancy. I didn't check into the Harbor Light Center. I didn't have reservations. Mr. White? No. I didn't have any luggage. I'm here. No. I was dropped off at the Harbor Light Center, more dead than alive, by my oldest brother, Will, in the state I described to you at the beginning of this meeting.
and they gave me a bed. And I did nothing but eat and sleep for the next 7 days while they detoxed me. And then I started coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and listening like only a dying person could hear. Because you see, I've been to a recovery home twice in 1985. First, only thinking I had a problem with drugs and not believing I was an alcoholic, and went home on a pass, and my brothers were playing dominoes and drinking Michelob. And I said, well, Michelob never really hurt you. And I drank, and the craving started, and I had another one and another one. And by the end of that night, I was back to the same place I had left. I went back to that recovery home 30 days later, and I went home on a pass again, now knowing I can't drink or use anything. And I saw that neighbor I used to work for, water the lawn for, across the street from my mother. And he said, Ronald, you don't drink or use anything? Well, you can sell this stuff for me. That experiment lasted 20 minutes. When I went to the Harbor Light Center, I didn't go home on no passes. I stayed in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I listened to men and women share from podiums just like this that I would come and then I would come to. And then I would come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Step two in the program of recovery, the spiritual solution to my spiritual problem. They told me that I needed to find a power that would stand in between me and that insane thought that would one day come again to visit me, that would say, this time it'd be different. And if I didn't have a power, I would succumb, that I would not be able to tell the truth from the lie. And they said, Ronald, many of us, I said, don't be calling it a higher power. You're talking about God, right? They said, many of us call it God. You can call it whatever you want to. And I said, well, God never worked for me. I've been raised in church. When it started getting bad for me with my drinking, I would go back to church and I would rejoin the church, rededicate myself to Christ, get rebaptized, and I would drink again. And I thought that God had forsaken me because of all of the things that I had done, the acts of betrayal, the lies, the deceit. What God would want to have anything to do with the animal that I had become? Wasn't the evidence of my life proof of that? That God had left me? They said, Ronald, who do you think has carried you through that mess? Who do you think has brought you to this place? We've got a chapter for a guy like you. Chapter 4. We agnostics, the spiritual kindergarten. And it's within the pages of that chapter that I rediscovered a relationship with a power that I have been looking at through somebody else's eyes all my life. I've always accepted somebody else's belief because there's a line in there that says this: deep inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, that he has sometimes been obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. But it tells me that if I am willing to search fearlessly, where? Within myself. We believe it is only there that he could be found. And I got hope because I've always looked for God in the sky, in my mother, in a preacher, in somebody else who has always seemed so much more godly, so much more spiritual than me, because I know me. If you know the way that I think, man, I would sit in church and there'd be this little girl next to me, and she'd rub those silk stockings next to each other. And if you knew what I thought, man, what God would, man. Oh, did I tell on myself a little too much? And so I thought there was something wrong with me. People would be in church and they would be, the music would get going and they'd go, and then they would say, woo! And I never felt that. And I thought there was something wrong with me. I've been in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, man, and I've heard men and women sharing from podiums like this. And inside I've said, woo! I'm much too cool to say it out loud, right? You know. But I got the connection here. Because it's said in a language that I understand here. And I understand now that I needed to have my own relationship, my own concept of this power. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, it told me all I need to do is be willing to believe. And that's enough to get started. And I got hope. I was in the Harbor Light Center for 130 days, and then they put me into a sober living home, a place called Harmony Hall.
a place for a sober living for the men from Harbor Light to start the transition back into real life. When you become an animal like me, you lose everything. I thought I had been disbarred for practicing law without a license. I never paid my bar dues. I always drank up the money. So when I got sober, I thought I could never be a lawyer. And I had no driver's license, no social security card. I had nothing, no clothes. They got me everything through that sober living. And the first job they hooked me up with was being a bookkeeper for a little old lady who had a nursing home. Let me share with you what that sounds. It sounds fancy, right? This is what I would do. I would catch the bus to this lady's house, and she would sit me on a chair in her living room, and she handed me a stack of her bills, and she took her checkbook, and she signed a bunch of blank checks. She gave me that checkbook, and she said, "Mr. White, I want you to pay all my bills and balance my checkbook, and I'll be back in a couple of hours." And she left me alone in her house with a bunch of blank signed checks. And I'm 5 months sober. And I'm scared. When she comes home 2 hours later, I'm still sitting in the chair where she left me. I handed her all her bills back, and they were sealed up with checks inside. And I gave her her checkbook back, and it was balanced, and there were no checks missing. And there was nothing missing in her house. And that lady paid me $40 a week to do that job. And when I caught the bus back to Harmony Hall with that $40 in my pocket, I felt 10 feet tall. Because it had been a long time since anybody had trusted me. And I didn't burn them. And I knew there was something about that spirit that had gotten so sick when I had started to drink was changing. And I grew closer to the power. When I was 10 months sober, sharing about how they were putting me out of Harmony Hall because they needed room for somebody else to come over from Harbor Light. And I'm hiding out in the sober living because I don't want to go back home to my mother's because that's where I drank. And I wanted to stay sober more than anything. And there was a lady that was bringing in a panel of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings into that sober living. Her name was Yvonne. I'll never forget her. And Yvonne came up to me at the end of the meeting, and she heard me sharing. She says, "Ronald," she says, "you can move into my apartment with me and my roommate Jenny until you get a home group and you feel comfortable enough to move back to your mom's house." Now, you know what I heard. I want you. You know how sexy we are at 10 months over, right? Yvonne let me move into her apartment, and I slept on her couch. She gave me a key, and I did nothing but catch a bus to what later became my home group, 9604 South Figueroa in South Central Los Angeles. And I had a job as a legal proofreader at the time. And she taught me the meaning of trust and unconditional love, and I grew closer to the power. When I was a year and a half sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, going to a lot of meetings and sharing from podiums, sounding real good, talking about, "The program works, keep coming back." And some friends of mine, I was just reminded of it when I celebrated my birthday this past week, and a friend of mine shared, Carl P., he and his wife, Sean, were at my girlfriend at the time's house, and I was sharing about how, you know, I was so, you know, unhappy at the job that I had. He says, "Ronald, you walk around the program talking about how you believe and trust in God. Why don't you call up the state bar and find out what's happening with your bar card?" Living in fear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you, I fear rejection so much, I won't even ask the question because I know the answer is going to be bad. And so instead, I just disbar myself. I call up the state bar. They say, "Mr. White, you haven't been disbarred, but you have been suspended for non-payment of dues. That's $2,500, your back dues. You pay that up, you can get your bar card back." Well, $2,500 sounded like $25,000 at the time. I had the job I had wasn't paying that much. I'm living at home with my mother. But, you know, it's amazing how much money you can save when you're not drinking.
I saved half of every paycheck for the next 6 months, and I wrote a check for $2,500 addressed to the State Bar of California, and they gave me my bar card back. 3 months later, somebody in the room says, Ronald, isn't it about time for you to apply for a job as a lawyer? Still living in fear, afraid of sending out that resume. You know where you got that gap. I got that 2-year gap. Harbor Light, Harmony Hall, bookkeeper. What law firm, you know, is going to want to? They said, Ronald, just put down the jobs you worked as an attorney and trust in God. I applied for a job, sent in a resume with the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office. They were doing interviews. I show up for an interview, and these five lawyers are sitting behind a table asking me questions about what would I do if this happened as a public defender, and what would I do? And I'm getting near the end of the interview, and nobody had asked me about that resume. And I'm thinking, yeah, I got over. And this smart-ass lawyer at the...
Mr. White, we notice you haven't been practicing law for the last 2 years. Why not?
I said, sir, I'm an alcoholic. I did not expect to say that. It was not planned, but you guys have me trained. You know, I said, sir, I'm an alcoholic. I said, I've been sober for 2 years. I said, well, Mr. White, lawyers do a lot of drinking. Don't you think the stresses of this position might make you want to drink again? I said, sir, it was stressful when I was out there. I said, I think God has prepared me to do this job. And they looked at me funny. I don't think they hear the G word. God, who is that? Is that a reference? Well, they don't know. That's my best reference. He said, Mr. White, okay, well, we'll contact you. We'll let you know in 10 days if you're on our waiting list or if we can hire you. And I left that day. It was a Wednesday. I didn't feel particularly good because of that alcohol stuff, right? They called me 3 hours after I got home and said, we want you in for another interview this Friday, Mr. White. And I said, shoot, probably want me to pee in a bottle. But I've been sober for 2 years. I am willing. When I showed up that Friday, they didn't ask me to pee in a bottle. They had me see the head public defender of Los Angeles County, a guy at the time named Wilbur Littlefield. Mr. Littlefield had me escorted to his office, which was on the top floor of the criminal courts building in downtown Los Angeles. He had me sit on a chair in his office, almost like that chair I sat in when I was that bookkeeper for that old lady. And I'm sitting in this chair, and Mr. Littlefield starts walking around for about 10 or 15 minutes talking about what public defenders do. And I'm sitting fidgeting in the chair like a witness in Perry Mason. And I'm, you know, I'm nervous, but I'm ready, right? I'm prayed up. I'd been to a meeting the night before. You know how they put me in a prayer circle, right? You know, we take care of each other, right? I'm ready, right? Come on with the questions about alcohol, right? But Mr. Littlefield just stops talking, and he doesn't ask me any questions about alcohol. He just gives me this funny look. And he walked over to the chair where I sat, and he held out his hand to me. And he said, Ron, we'd be proud to have you join our office. Didn't he know just 2 years before I was sleeping on my mother's floor, stealing the food out her refrigerator, cooking plates for people around the neighborhood? What is that but a miracle? Alcoholics Anonymous takes broken up pieces of men and women working with the guidance of a loving God who works through the unselfish men and women who toil in this fellowship. We put the pieces back together again. It was as if each man and woman who sits in this room tonight were standing in the lobby of the Harbor Light Center when I arrived there more dead than alive, with my chin on my chest, too ashamed to look you in the face. And you guys walked up to me, and you placed your hand underneath my chin, and you lifted up my head. And even more than that, you wrapped your arms around me, as dirty and as filthy And as nasty as I was, you guys wrapped your arms around me and you literally loved me back to life. Damn. See, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous isn't about who's got the best pitch from the podium, who's got the nicest looking suits, who's got the most babies, who's got the biggest car in the parking lot, who's got the biggest bank account. Alcoholics Anonymous is about gaining access to the power. The power that I've come to know that is so great, so good, so forgiving, so loving, it can do anything but fail. February 8th of 1991, I found myself standing in the lobby, not in the lobby, in the delivery room of Kaiser Hospital in West Los Angeles, cutting the umbilical cord on my son, Ronald Jr., no ego. I may have had it backwards, but 3 months later, I married the mother of my son. This past May, we celebrated 25 years of marriage. When I met my future wife, she had a daughter who was about 6 years old, Terrence. Some of you guys know the challenges of being a step-parent, of being somebody who steps into a child's life and supposedly getting in between them and their mom or their father, whoever it might be. And it was a struggle gaining this relationship with Terrence. And I tried to buy her friendship, buy her love, and do all that kind of stuff until I stopped and started practicing the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my home, in my relationship. When Terrence graduated from high school, she introduced me to all of her friends as her dad. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was about 12 years sober, I found myself standing on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C., because I had been invited there by the President of the United States because he heard about the work I was doing in my community as a public defender. And they wanted my input on a federal crime bill they were putting together. Standing on the lawn of the White House, hell, I was watering the lawn for the dope man. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. In Bill's story, Bill says, after Ebby had visited him in the hospital when he started going through the steps, he said, an alcoholic could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead, right? If I could not perfect and enlarge my spiritual life through strenuous work and self-sacrifice for others. And he said there were certain trials and low spots ahead. 2 years ago, in 2014, in June, I found myself sitting in my car in the parking lot of my law office contemplating suicide. I had just received a letter from the State Bar of California telling me of their intent to disbar me, to take away my license to practice law, because I had represented someone who was doing something illegal, and I had not been watching his activities as closely as I should have. And the thing that I dreamed of having all of my life, that I worked for 35 years doing, that it allowed me to do all kinds of things that I had only dreamed of, was being taken from me, and I felt lost. And my ego told me that my friends, that my family, that everyone that I knew would be ashamed of me and that they would not want to have anything to do with me. Ego, pride and ego will kill me. And I don't know which meeting it was that I had gone to. I don't know which sponsee it was that I had talked to. I don't know which hug it was that you had given me. I don't know which thing it was that got me through the darkness, that got me home, where my wife, when I told her what had happened, and I expected her to break down and crying and a panic and all of this. And she looked at me and she told me, honey, it's going to be okay. And when I told my mother, and my mother cried, and she said, it's going to be okay. And I got on the phone with a dear friend of mine and Alcoholics Anonymous, Polly Pistol. And I called her my big sister. And I talked to Polly and she told me, Ronnie, it's going to be okay. And I went to a convention. I was going to a convention that very next week in Nashville, and I sat down with Steve L. and with Kent C. And I'm talking about how I felt and about how embarrassed I was. And they shared things from their lives that helped me get through that moment. And I said, who would want me to be a representative of alcohol? You're not no representative. You're a member. I said, who would want me to speak after that? Who would want me to share something with? She says, Ronnie, don't you know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more that you fuck up, the more they're going to love to hear your excuse my language, that was a quote. And I got through those moments. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been able to walk through the valley with some grace because of you. And I understand when one door closes, another one opens. And so I'm so very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous to be an anchor in my life. I like to share what happens to me. You know, some of you, we say that this is all just really for the newcomers. This is for everybody. Because we have people silently suffering in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous who have long-term sobriety, who are going through things that their pride and ego won't let them tell people. And we hide from our help. I'm here to share with anybody who sits within the reach of my voice that Alcoholics Anonymous, in the good times and the bad, works. I am a living testament to that. I want to again thank the committee for inviting me to come out and share. And I want to thank each and every one of you for my life. Thank you for letting me share.